I'm John Wallace. I'm an economist at the University of Maryland. I've been talking most of the week about how politics and economics interact in the process of economic and social development. And I know we're supposed to have all these talks be independent and self-standing, but that doesn't work. You know, don't get to Friday. You talk about a lot of things, you know, so you start over again on Monday or whatever. So what I want to talk about today sort of builds on things I've been talking about all week long. And as the title of the session is Christians Must Think, Why Christians Must Think, and as Chris Sharon says, does that apply? They don't. And not necessarily, but there's some things that I think we should think about and should think about how we think about. So that's what I want to get to. So I'm going to kind of squish together what I was planning on talking about yesterday, and then said we did this sort of Jubilee stuff, and today. The framework I've been talking about is kind of what we could call a social orders, and how violence is contained and managed in different social orders. What we can call a limited access order, and societies that begin to appear about 10,000 years ago, 5,000 years ago, certainly by the time that there was Uruk, you know, Ur of the Chaldeans and all that kind of stuff, the city-states that appeared in Mesopotamia, had a society in which powerful individuals were controlled, managed, because the society, the political element of the society, limited access to economic activities, both owning land, but also, much more importantly, valuable functions like who could trade, who could fight, who could pray. And because the people who could perform those functions were limited, they got what economists would call rents from performing those functions. That is, they got a return that was solely due to the fact that they had the privilege of doing that thing. Okay? And because these elites were military, religious, economic, cultural, whatever, they formed an interlocking set of interests in which, if any of them did anything to break the peace and caused violence to break out, the value of the rents for all of them would go down. Okay? So this was not a society like ours where there's the state possesses a monopoly of control over violence, but a society in which control over violence was dispersed between, not everybody had it, but powerful individuals were set in relationship to one another, and what bound them together was the political manipulation of the economy. Okay? In the society that we live in the United States today, and in about 25 countries around the world, beginning after 1800, we moved to what we can think of as open access societies. Societies in which, rather than control over violence being dispersed through the population, in which there's a monopoly of violence. And Ingrid went home today, she was talking about capital punishment. We give the state the power to kill people. It costs, what, $250,000 to bring one of those cases, because the conditions under which the state can kill somebody judicially are very well constrained and described. But that monopoly on violence in the military and police, which can be used to create negative sanctions for all of us, but also then must be embodied in a kind of rule of law, which can govern lots of relationships other than violence, contractual relationships, political relationships, cultural relationships, churches, that control over violence is constrained by the political system, because the political system has the ability both to appoint the people who have control over violence and the people who make the decisions about whether those people with the ability to use violence have obeyed the rules or not. We all know that power that the governments possess in developed countries is enormous. And the power to enforce laws must, of course, also be the power to break laws. The power to protect property rights must be the power to expropriate property. How do we control that power? In America, we learn, oh, it's the checks and balances in the Constitution.
We know they can't be because we sent the same, you know, they took the same constitution to Bolivia and Venezuela and Colombia. It doesn't work. So the main part of the understanding of how our society works is that, in fact, open access to economic and political competition is necessary for both to occur. That is, people need to be able, and here's a crucial element, they need to be able to form organizations that can compete, whether it's economically, whether it's politically, whether it's religiously, the culture, museums, education, you name it, the state puts at the service of everyone who is a citizen, not necessarily everyone in the society, obviously, puts at the hands of all citizens the tools that enable them to form organizations. In the natural state, in a limited access society, the only people who get to form organizations are members of the elite. So that natural states, limited access societies, are characterized by these very powerful patronage networks. And they vary in name from society to society. Chris was just talking about Senegal and sort of the tribal structures. We can think about organized crime. We can think about lots of different things. So that the ability to form an organization is incredibly powerful. And in limited access, the ability to form an organization that the larger society will support is limited to elites. How many churches were there in medieval Europe? And that church defended that privilege. It would kill people. Okay? And we all know that, right? We see it as a part of the Lutheran heritage, that breaking that up. Okay? Although, of course, how many true churches do we believe there are? We got to go there. Okay. We have to go there. In our faith, we believe there's only one true church, and we believe that a society with only one church doesn't work. We have to think that through. Yeah. The numbers I have up here on the board are the things I've worked on over the last year or two. Actually, these numbers are numbers that I've known for a long time. So this is per capita income. This is in 2000, so this is in $2,000. So here's the first row is countries with less than $200. These are countries between $300 and $200 per capita income. This is really poor. This is between $1 and $6 per day, okay, average income. And so, of course, there's usually unequal distribution of income. In those societies, the total amount of income that goes to the central government, that's revenues and expenditures really don't matter, but this is an expenditure measure, is 29%. So 29% of every dollar generated in this economy, or, you know, it's not dollars, it could be a Squatos or yuan or apples, or the person wants me to barter.
What's the top word?
Central government. Okay. I'm sorry. You know, I don't write very well. That's why I use the word frustrated. Okay. This is, I'm going to call this local government, but what we really mean here is non-national government. So in America, this would be state and local governments. In Canada, it would be provincial and local governments. Okay, this is all the non-national governments. And here's the total government. Again, this is as a percentage of income. Now, remember the other day, on Monday, I had some numbers up, and there were about 200 countries that we have data on incomes for. Data on government is much less reliable and much more difficult to get because many countries are actually don't publish data on how much they have. So this is for 87 countries in the world for which we have data on central government, and there's 75 countries for which we have reliable data on subnational government expenditures. This is data that's collected and published every year by the International Monetary Fund. So because the countries are not exactly the same in the two columns don't quite add up. Okay? Even though this column, which is total, is the sum of these two. It's the sum for every individual country. And there's 12 countries in this column that are not in that column. So don't worry about
the fact that 37 plus 30 is not 53. So here's the takeaway from this table that's really important is that when we look across income, there's very little relationship between the size of the central government and the size of the income. There's a little bit of a positive relationship. 29, 26, 25, 32, 31, 37. So we get big at the end. And above 20,000 countries are really different from the other countries. They're much bigger here. They were bigger when we talked about income growth on Monday and how they perform. They're very different on measures of civil society, civil rights, and that sort of thing. But they're really, really different in terms of subnational governments, in terms of local governments, where that goes. In poorest countries, that's only 4%. 5% in countries from $2,000 to $5,000. 13% from $5,000 to $10,000. 16% from $10,000 to $15,000. 6% from $15,000 to $20,000. And 30%. In other words, as a percentage of income, in the rich countries have as big a state and local sector as the poorest countries have total government. Does anybody know how many governments there are in the United States? At last count, 81,000. One national government, 50 state governments, 3,000 county governments, and roughly 78,000 other kinds of governments. In 1940, when they did the first complete count, there were over 100,000 school districts in the United States. There was 4,000 in Nebraska, which, as by my count, is roughly one for every 12 students. Now, why is this important? What did I say distinguishes limited access from open access? What's the key difference?
Organizations.
Organizations, corporations, as we talked a little bit about on Wednesday, are not just business corporations. It's not just Walmart. Holden Village is a corporation. Chelan County is an organization. The ELCA is an organization. In fact, the ELCA is a corporation, as is Holden Village. There are 1,700,000 corporations in the United States. There are over 5 million formal organized businesses. There are over 500,000 organized charitable entities that actually file with the IRS for tax purposes so that their members and donations are tax-free. How many organizations are there in Senegal? No, anywhere near that many. In fact, when they go around to kind of count organizations and look at civil society, which is a big deal in the social sciences, but it's also now a big deal for the World Bank and for development organizations. We know that NGOs, non-government organizations that go into developing countries are trying to get organizations started. Jody Kretschmer was here, he just left this morning. He was talking about community development in America and around the world, and it's all about doing what? Building organizations in these communities. Because when we go to these places like the South Bronx, what's fallen apart is the government, and how do they get themselves organized? And the high-income countries have way more organizations, even government organizations. But it wouldn't matter which one we went to. We counted private sector organizations, corporations, bridge clubs, whatever, reading groups. Kit said on Monday afternoon that in China, if you're an organization, you're a threat to the state. So all powerful organizations are closely tied to the state. The privilege of having an organization is, in fact, what makes the rents that hold the elite together. Now, I could spend a lot more time. In fact, I had planned on spending an hour, but I don't want to spend an hour talking about all this. When we think about Jubilee yesterday, and the passages from Leviticus, we talked a little bit about redistribution, but that's partly what Jubilee is about. There's two legitimate ways to redistribute income. What are they?
Taxes.
What?
Taxes.
Charity. Okay, people can voluntarily give their money to other people. It could be rich to poor, it could be poor to rich. People always are surprised to find out in the United States that local governments actually transfer money to states. Well, the other way around. How many of you know people who are less wealthy than you and give more than you do? Right? So charity. What do we call it? What do we call income redistribution that's not legitimate? Theft.
Crime.
Okay. So that when we look around the world at places that are actually consciously redistributing income, that is not taking the outcome of the social patterns as given, we tend to find they have much bigger governments. In fact, what distinguishes these bigger governments at the, in the rich countries is the amount of redistribution they do. In Finland, government is about 60% of GNP, actually a little bit more than that. So 60 cents out of every dollar that is earned by a Finn, by Nokia, right, goes to government. Now the largest category in Finland of employment is women taking care of other women's children. Right? They have an enormously diverse, dense social welfare network. Does bigger government, larger social welfare, taking care of people, produce lower income?
Yes.
Okay. Show me. How many of you have heard a politician or Rush Limbaugh say, if we raise taxes, the economy will slow down? Okay, so the rest of you don't listen.
Not to Rush.
That's to Rush Limbaugh, but you don't have to listen to Rush Limbaugh. You can hear it from the Democrats. Democrats, they do not have the guts to stand up and say, if we made our government larger, if we took care of more people, we'd be better off. They don't say it. Right?
But they believe it.
They believe it? Well, if they don't, they don't have the courage of their convictions. We spend money on 89-year-olds and not on 1-year-olds. If you were making a simple calculation as an economist of who you would rather spend a dollar on, an 89-year-old to keep them alive for 3 more weeks, or a 1-year-old, who would you spend it on?
The 1-year-old,
because you get the money back. Okay? Now, the problem is that in most countries, if we transfer more income to the government, what do they do with it?
Waste.
No.
Or they make tanks.
No. That goes to Switzerland.
Right.
We were talking last night about, you know, what happens when the World Bank money goes into the place and they don't build the bridge?
Yeah, it goes to Switzerland.
Yeah. What do we, what did the U.S., what do we put on the television all the time after we invaded Iraq? All of Saddam Hussein's palaces, all the stuff he had, all the things that went to him. And the explicit and implicit message is, wouldn't the Iraqi people have been better off if all this resources that they produced went to them instead of to him? Hugo Chavez? Putin? Okay.
Halliburton.
Right. Okay. Have you read Harry Potter, Mad-Eye Moody always says, eternal vigilance. There is nothing in our system that makes people be good. The Republicans, just like the Democrats, want to give more money and more resources to their supporters. What prevents them from doing it? What? No. Do not say that. The voters, political competition. If you cannot, we cannot live in our country and say our country does not work as well or better than any place else in the world when it comes to regulating what our politicians do. Okay? You just can't say that. Because that flies in the face of everything we see when we look around the world at the way governments behave. But what constrains Halliburton and Cheney is the Democrats, which is why we're in trouble, is political competition. Okay? It doesn't matter what the laws are, there's always ways to move money around. In places where you think the government is going to waste the money, you do not want to transfer money to the government in an attempt to redistribute. So the only places that do that on a large scale are places that have high income, but they have high income because their government has gotten the ability to actually provide secure property rights and to manage a monopoly on violence in a way that people can credibly believe will work. In those societies, they're willing to have Social Security. They're willing to have income redistribution. Which of the developed societies that have the smallest governments, does anybody know? You're living in one. United States, Japan, Hong Kong, Singapore, Taiwan. Hong Kong, Singapore, Taiwan are not countries, they're cities. They're big cities. Taiwan's an island, right? Japan and the United States have the smallest governments by significant amounts of all the really, you know, full-sized countries. Why? Well, we distribute less. We redistribute less. We don't trust our government. You know, we say that, of course, we've said it, right? People say it all the time. We have some learning to do. And believe me, I have a PhD in economics. I went to the university, I have a postdoctoral research fellowship at the University of Chicago. I played tennis with Milton Friedman. Okay?
Did you win?
Yes! It was a great story. I was playing with another guy named Greg, and I don't know, you guys probably don't have, you know, pictures of the Nobel laureates in economics on your wall. We played Gary Becker, who won the Nobel Prize in the mid-80s, and Milton Friedman. Milton Friedman's about this tall. And Gary Becker's about this tall. And Greg and I were big, young, strapping guys, and we got out there with, you know, and it was like, I just got out of grad, I just had a PhD So we lost the first set, and we looked at each other and said, okay, it doesn't matter if our careers go in the toilet, we cannot lose to these guys. So we beat them. And, you know, there were my jobs at the University of Chicago. Okay. So I know all the arguments. Okay, I mean, it's not, you know, and I told you in the meeting, you're not going to be able to figure out whether I'm liberal or conservative. Because I got both sides going. Okay? The real evidence is that growing government does not reduce economic growth. It may be a positive effect, it may be a negative effect, it may be a zero effect. It's a really, really tiny effect because the variation is all in the rich countries. And they tend to be very good at using resources from the taxpayer to actually provide public services. That doesn't mean there's no waste. Of course there's waste. How many of you work at a church? Is there waste? Yeah, we're going to throw food away this afternoon. How many of you work in a business? How many of you have a job? Is there waste?
Yeah.
Yes, always. People pick their nose. They do stuff, you know. That's what human beings are about. They're not necessarily about, I'm going to work absolutely as hard as I can every minute of the day. Right? That Jubilee reminds us, don't do that. Right? There's always waste. There's always inefficiency. There's always cost. The question is it minimized in some way? Okay? How do we do that? And so we do it through political competition. And the key is that we can only moderate political competition if there's other kinds of competition in the society. Are there any monopolies in America? What? Microsoft?
No.
Nope. Never ever was.
IBM was always there.
No, IBM was never the only maker of computers.
What about the U.S. mail?
What? That's a monopoly. Well, of course, now it's a monopoly subject to competition because of UPS and FedEx and DHL and all that kind of stuff.
Email.
What? Email? Yeah, email's got me, right? There are very, very few really monopolies in the United States. Even so, we have laws against monopoly, but in fact, as we discovered, you know, the economists debated this for a long time in the early 20th century and realized that it only takes two competitors to not have a monopoly. But of course, two competitors are more dangerous because if they cooperate, right, they can do things. But economic competition is necessary to sustain political competition. And this goes for religion as well. We have religious competition in the United States. Do all of you like it? No. Because you don't like some of the religions. Right? And we think, oh, you know, if we're religious, we shouldn't have, who was the guy that had the 5,000 Club or 3,000 Club or whatever it was, the guy, Pat Robertson? You know? In fact, we think it's really dangerous when somebody says, I'm running for president and you ought to vote for me because God picked me. Right? But will be any president who stands up and says, you know, this God stuff is crazy. You know, what chance he got of getting elected?
Zero.
We believe that people ought to believe, and we believe that they ought to believe that everybody ought to be able to believe what they want to believe. That's a pretty easy one. But, so that it's really important to understand, to think about, the fact that both the competition and actually when I say competition, you all think I'm a capitalist. Maybe you don't. And we have all kinds of loaded words. And I think competition is really good. What I really am talking about is access, is entry. Okay, that we let people do things. That we put at anybody's disposal the ability to form an organization which can be involved in economics, politics, religion, culture, education. What's the one thing they can't do? What's the real legitimate monopoly in our society on? Yeah, violence. Right? If General Motors goes out and starts breaking people's arms if they don't buy Malibus, they will cease to be a corporation within a few months. The government will take all of its support for that organization away. Yeah? In fact, the organizations in America that use violence are called what?
Police.
The police, that they're legitimate. What else?
Gangs
or organized
crime.
Okay. There's what's called the RICO statute, which are about anybody who conspires together to use violence is automatically, on its face, illegal. To prosecution.
What about the right to bear arms and the right to self-defense?
How's now that means that we have a lot of violence in the United States that most societies don't.
Yeah, it does.
It does. Okay, and here what's really important about that is that everybody has the right to bear arms. And because we have the right to bear arms, we have a really high murder rate. And we have a really high injury rate from firearms. And we're like, you know, 4 or 5 times Europe. I mean, we're just off the charts high level of violence. And we shouldn't be. Okay, so this is personal opinion. We ought to just get rid of all the guns.
Yeah.
Right? We ought to have laws like they have in most countries. I just can't do this. Okay. Now what happens if 3 people get together to use their guns?
Militia?
They're in deep, deep trouble. If you commit a crime using a gun in most states, you are going to get punished enormously higher for doing exactly the same thing because you had a gun. Okay. That we have this issue about whether we should let them have the gun. And we said, yeah, we should. That should be one of our rights. And we debate that. I think that's, you know what? You know what I'm stuck with now? I've got to accept a bunch of stuff I don't like. That's an open access society making these choices. I don't like a bunch of choices they make, and I have to shut up. Kind of. You know, as an economist. I can, as a person, as a voter, I can say I'm against this, I want to vote against this, I can organize, right? And I can actually do something to change.
Has the Department of Homeland Security grown our government and been a benefit?
Okay. So we got the John Wall's economist, John Wall's person, and Homeland Security is a just terrible thing. You know, I absolutely hate the Transportation Security Administration. I want to scream every time I go through an airport. But now, back over here, it's what we voted for. You know, I mean, as Kim was talking about today, we're concerned about what's going on in the Middle East, right? And we decided to devote a bunch of money to do it.
That's it. You know, my personal opinion is we don't need to spend that money doing that. I don't feel any safer flying on airplanes today than I used to. And I really don't like it that the government caps phones and does a bunch of stuff that they're not supposed to do. That's what, you know, that they bent some of those rules. But that's the choice we have, and we have a choice. We can go vote those guys out, right? And unfortunately, last election we voted the other guys in, and they're not doing squat, right? So we got to, you know, what do we have to do? Organize.
Yeah, organize.
Right? I'm not going to do that.
You can do it.
Okay, I got to talk about why I'm not going to do it. Because I want to talk about, now the Bible study, I've done my first 30 minutes, so we go to the easy part. Have you been to Bible study this week? The first part's the easy part, and the second part's the hard part.
Right.
The second part is, how does this affect your life? Okay, how does all this stuff I've been talking about affect your life? I don't, here we go. I talked about an idea that I have, that, and I talked about docs. I'm a historian as well as an economist. I'm an economic historian. And so a bunch of what I do is actually try to find out what happened in the past. Just literally go trying to establish things that I think are true. And of course, some of the things I think are true, probably 10 years from now, I think aren't true or didn't happen. But what actually occurred? And then I put those facts into stories, into explanations. So all history is made up of a combination of things that happened and ways of thinking about why they happened, about the stories and the facts. Okay? And what I wanted to do this week was to begin to get you to think about societies in a different way, to connect the dots up in a little bit different way. What did I call that kind of story?
Faith.
And I almost said, oh, I should just recite the Apostles' Creed. What do I believe? Right? We all have said it. We've said it together. Although I don't know if we've said it together since this week. Have we?
Not this week.
Maybe we will tomorrow on Sunday night. Say the Nicene Creed. I say that, and all my life I've been saying it and thinking about it. And I understand that one of the most terrible and awful things about being Christian is that that is an empty circle. I'm redeemed. We talked about a lot about redemption in Jubilee yesterday, about land being redeemed. And the opening sentence in Leviticus 25 is when God says, I own all the land. You are my tenants. You are as tenants and aliens. But you can redeem it. We're redeemed by faith through grace. No dots in there. You got to believe it or not. No matter how much evidence you put together, no matter how much you read the stuff, you believe it or you don't. You know, I wrestle with that every day. Do I believe this? In my mind, what do I believe? Paul's matins on Tuesday, Paul? Wednesday?
Yeah.
Talked about justice versus mercy. That if God brings us justice, we all fry in hell. Justice inevitably involves history. It involves dots. It involves who we are and what we did. Grace says, dots don't matter. You have been redeemed by something that Christ did, not what you did. And you have to believe, and if you don't believe, it doesn't matter what you did. I'm probably on theologically shaky ground, but that's how I see it. Now that means that as Christians, we live in faith without dots, and there is no history in that redemption. But we need to teach our children, we need to relate to one another, we need to have some continuity in what we do, and that's going to require history. That's going to require
organization. That's going to require some persistent identities for people as Christians that last through time. And grace is not about time. It's not about history. It's about redemption. So how do we live in a world where we're told to care for the poor, to care for the sojourner, to care for the widow, to care for the orphan, to care for the brother who has less than you, to care for the brother who has more than you? How do we do that? You know? And do we only do it in the context of our faith and what we feel inside? Do we just go around doing good? How do we know that? Well, it makes me feel okay. You know, I've got this image of Martin Luther once said, doing good for your neighbor is doing what is good for your neighbor. Not what's good for you. This morning, Bradley talked about Acts, in Acts 28, and I'll get to the part about Rome and the Jews in Israel in a minute. But what really struck me this morning was him talking about the faithfulness of God. Right? That we believe in the faithfulness of God. If we believe this, he will be faithful to his promises to us. Okay? And that's this circle. That's timeless. That's not history. That's a promise. But good old Paul was getting hammered by his fellow Jews, who said, you're not obeying the laws, guy. So what did Paul do to get out from under that? He said, I'm a Roman. He didn't change the law. He said, I'm a Roman. I'm not under your jurisdiction here. I'm under Caesar's jurisdiction. Get me out of here. Right? Wasn't he a lawyer? Some kind of lawyer kind of things there. So Paul goes to Rome. Paul goes to Rome and lives there in house arrest. I don't think he was in chains. Kept saying he was chained. He was in chains. He's living with the prisoner, the guard, the guy that come to see him and doing all this kind of stuff. He's in Rome. Okay? Now, the dots, the way Roman society was organized was different than the way Jewish society was organized in Israel and Palestine in the first century BC. And in which society was it easier to have religious thoughts that weren't conforming? In Rome. I got my faith, and I want my faith to live in society, and I want to shape the society around me to reflect my faith. Should the faith-based set of institutions and government be better for people than hedonistic, secular, pantheistic, Roman, awful Augustus Caesar declares world? Well, for Paul, nope. That story doesn't say that living the law of God made it easier for Christ's message to be heard. How do we structure our societies? I know to go to prisons and visit people, which I don't do. I know to go to soup kitchens and feed people, which I don't do. I know to give my money to the poor, which I don't do. I go to the World Bank and consult. So this is my admission, this is my witness that since I've been in Holden Village and before, my parents, I come from a wonderful family, I've told you that before, and I feel a real obligation to make use of my life in some way. And so this is what I do. I'm trying to convince myself that if I can actually figure this stuff out a little bit,
and it makes the world work better, that that'll have a huge impact on millions and maybe billions of people. And maybe I'm just whistling in the dark and keeping my money in my pocket and, you know, not spending my time the way I should. I don't know. We all have to make those choices. But I really, really think that Christians have to think about the world around them. And how it really works. It's not enough to say, although it is enough to say, I'm going to visit the poor, I'm going to go to prison, I'm going to do that. And if all of us did that, the world would change, right? But we know that the lives of most people, including the poor and the helpless and the oppressed, they're not at Holden Village very often, right, are created by and live in a society in which social structures and law really matter, in which how society functions and fits together really, really makes a difference. And we can, in the graph that I had up, this is income per capita or whatever. This is modern economic development. I could erase this. I could put a civil rights. I could erase this. I could put up suffrage. I could erase this. I could put up life expectancy. I could erase this. I could put 1 over infant mortality. I could put up lots of stuff that have been transformed over the last 200 years in the 25 countries that have become developed. There is transformation all throughout the world. One of my favorite stories is about modern technology is there's a tribe in Brazil in the rainforest that is so isolated and simple, I don't want to say primitive, that they only have words for the numbers 0, 1, and 2. So they have words for the number for 0, 1, and more than 1. And so some linguists and anthropologists were designing an experiment to go down and talk to these people because they wanted to see if mathematical abilities, you know, could they add 7 and 4 and come up with 11? And so they went down there, and of course they had to be really careful because just simply talking to them would change their view of the world and perhaps, you know, contaminate the experiment. So they had these very carefully designed tests for the people to do, and they wanted them to use familiar objects. So guess what 3 objects they used? Sticks, stones, and
water?
Batteries.
But they don't want to change the culture.
Now these people, legit, are so isolated that they don't have a word for 3. Yet, they're familiar with batteries.
Huh.
They must have flashlights or something. They must be integrated into some way to do that. So there has been income rising everywhere in the world because the technological changes that have occurred over the last 200 years, cotton cloth, plastic, electricity, that stuff spread everywhere. Of course, that doesn't mean everybody has electricity in their home, right? But our ability to make things with fewer resources and with less labor has in fact made many, many more things available to many people. But most countries are still somewhere down here, and they're not moving up this way. Their conditions are getting better. Why are the poor poor? Now this is a question, this is the quiz part of the week.
Because they go backwards.
Because they go backwards more often, and when they go backwards really fast, they end up being really poor. So
So the poorest countries in the world grow in about the same number of years that they shrink. And when they shrink much faster. They shrink roughly at the rate that they grow. So over time, their rate of growth is almost zero. Okay? So why is it that those societies are poor? Well, if we think about the nature of social relationships in a limited access world, if the political system is manipulating the economy to solve the problem of violence, and something happens, there's a hurricane, the price of food goes up, the price of oil goes up, the price of food goes down. You're in Brazil and the price of coffee goes down. You need to make adjustments. Okay? You have to make adjustments because the best options for using your resources have changed. But if you start making adjustments in either politics or economics in a world in which political and economic arrangements also serve to limit violence, what's always a possibility? Violence. Last night, Jody talked about the World Bank, and he said what happens is you take these countries where they have all these subsistence farmers, and the World Bank comes in and says you'd be richer if you started, if you developed an export crop, so that the farmers get less developed and they move towards monoculture, that is, they grow the thing at which they have a comparative advantage, and they begin to export. And Jody said that's bad, and so I agreed with it, but what happens actually when you look at economic in African countries, it tends to be that the ruling coalition, whether the World Bank is doing this or not, is trying to get the farmers to produce cash crops which they can then tax to feed their allies in the cities. Okay? And in fact, most African countries have most of them have a sort of pro-urbanization and anti-agrarian bias built into them. Not all of them, but most of them. Which is why Africa is starving sometimes. Because they've had... The incentives are not to be a farmer, they're to be an urban worker. Okay? But when those arrangements between the farmers and what they call agricultural marketing boards, so that the state markets all the coffee for all the farmers or the sugar or the whatever it is, when the price of one of those resources changes and you're supposed to allocate resources, you know, in Indiana, when the price of corn goes up, they plant more corn. Right? Now they plant a lot of corn because the government subsidizes for putting in our gas tanks. Right? But when the price of corn goes up or down, the people have to be free to switch out of corn and into soybeans or into wheat or whatever. In the United States, do we worry about that causing violence? No. But in some of these African countries, yeah. Because what you grow is a decision that's not completely up to you. Right? And if you've got a political system where one of the big payoffs is being the right to harvest diamonds, or sell the oil, or market the cocoa, or market the coffee, that when economic events occur that change the returns, or when there's a climate shock or anything, those societies have a really tough time making the kinds of adjustments within their society. Because if they make the wrong adjustment, violence might break out. Chris, we're talking about Senegal, and Senegal's been relatively peaceful, but it may be that Senegal's been relatively peaceful because they've managed to lock things in, which means they're relatively poor. Because they can't move out of corn into soybeans. They can't move out of cotton into whatever.
Peanuts.
What?
Peanuts.
Peanuts, right. Okay. So these societies that are poorer grow, have a tendency to, when things shift, to break down. And sometimes that breakdown involves violence. And when the breakdown involves violence, those countries go backwards. I think it's great to say the kind of stuff that Jody Kretschmer is doing and Small is Beautiful and Schumacher and things that World Bank is doing and people are doing to promote development about going in on a small scale and get people to be more productive and all that. I am 100% behind that, although I don't think it's going to produce economic development. It'll make people better off, and I think that's a really good thing. It'll make them healthier, maybe give them higher income, These societies need to solve this problem of integrating politics and economics and violence in a way. Now, when I say Christians must think, I'm not just saying, oh, you got to get a PhD in economics and be like me. I'm not saying that, because most people with PhDs in economics aren't like me. Okay? And, you know, but we need to think about what we're doing. I mean, I think this idea about fair trade coffee is okay, you know, but then we're going to say, well, you know, the Vietnamese coffee growers are bad and the Venezuelan coffee growers are good, so we're going to give more money to Venezuelan coffee than the Vietnamese coffee makers. And I'm like, whoa, where'd you figure that out? Where'd you figure that the way Vietnam was organized and the coffee growers were organized there was worse than the way they are in Venezuela?
More Christians in Venezuela.
That could be. I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, if we raise the minimum wage, do we make people worse off? Some people do lose their jobs. Some people keep their jobs. How do we figure these things out? If we simply put that off the table because we say our obligation is to be good, it's to be for poor people, and I don't have to think about it, I just have to say I want poor people to be better off. And I don't have to think about what I'm doing. That's a problem for, that's got to be a problem for us. It's got to be a problem for us. It's got to be a problem for us. It's got to be a problem when we say, what kind of organizations do we want to have with respect to religion? I love Old Village. You know, I haven't been here for 28 years. It's been great being back. I love the conversation, and I'm really, over the last couple of years, the level of conversation has just grown and grown, and it's absolutely fantastic. And we're reading Acts, and Acts is all about what?
Spirit moves.
That's how we've been interpreting. What is it also about?
Starting an organization.
Yeah. It is, right? It's about how does the church identify who it is? We're all rooting for the guys who want to baptize uncircumcised Gentiles. I got circumcised, you know, so it didn't really matter. But that turned out to something my parents did. We don't know whether the half of us that have that possibility are circumcised or not. And we're not going to, I'm not asking you to show me. We needed in that time not only to have the Spirit of God move us, we needed to decide how we would be organized. Because we needed a history, as well as grace. Grace wasn't enough. It's enough for me, and it's enough for every single one of us. God will redeem all of us if we have faith. I believe that. But if we want to change the world, we need to think. We need to be organized. And how we're organized has a tremendous effect on what we do, as the example of Rome and Israel tell us with regard to Paul. Being Christian does not automatically tell us how to run our governments, or structure our societies, or structure our churches. It's been great having Bradley here, doing the Bible study and talking about, should the Lutheran ELCA, what should it do about ordaining gay ministers in an active relationship? We can say, I'm a Christian and I'm for that. See, I'm a Christian, I'm against it. Right? And we got to be really careful about saying, God told me.
we better think through the implications of what we do. Is Christianity a tolerant religion?
No.
No. No. No. Christianity does not get tolerant until really recently. And I loved it, all the Bible says when we read about Acts, the Spirit moves us and we just want to leave, bring everybody in and do all that kind of stuff. Of course, that's not what the Christian church did.
No.
Right? It was a state church for a really long time. Lutheran are still state churches in some places. Okay? There's nothing inherent in being Christian that says, I'm going to be tolerant. There's something inherent in faith that says, I must be tolerant because you can be saved and redeemed, and that's not my choice. And so I can never believe that you're not a member of the community of saints. What was the text on, was it on Sunday night about the weeds and the wheat?
Yeah.
Don't harvest the weeds first because you don't know what the wheat's going to look like. Wait until the crop matures. Guess what? We got to wait forever. Because it won't be till the end of time that we know who the weeds were and who the wheat were. But we need to think then about what and how we structure our lives and how that impacts social outcomes. And this is a really, really good outcome. We can say, oh, capitalism's bad. We say we use too much resources and we don't take care of the earth. And all that stuff is in a way true. Okay? But it's also, and we need to think about that, debate about it, talk about it. But we should think about it, debate about it, talk about it without saying the people who run large corporations are evil. Because they're mostly Lutheran. No, they're not. No. But a lot, some of them are. Right?
A lot of them went to Wheaton College.
Right? Okay. Right? We live in a society that's powerful and has powerful organizations within it, like the ELCA. And what makes our society work is not having tiny little organizations where everybody is not powerful. We operate very well because we have lots of powerful organizations that are in competition with one another, like, was it International Paper? Who'd you work for yet? Right? We need to think that if we're really concerned about poverty, that this process has eliminated more poverty than anything ever. And it's done it at the same time that it increased rights. It's done it at the time that it increased safety. It's done it at the time that women get to vote. In the last half century, it's at a time that gay people get to be ministers. Right? Does that exist for most of human history?
No.
It doesn't even remotely exist through most of human history. And we could pick out pieces where one of those things may have happened. But in a systematic kind of way, societies are organized so a relatively small number of people get the rents, get the returns. Is that because those people are evil? No, it's because if you don't organize society that way, society falls apart. Okay. When we think about economic development, we gotta think about, this is my own bugaboo lately, because I'm not an economic development person, I'm an American economic historian. You should be talking to you about early 19th century America, but that's not nearly as fun as this. Actually, it will be. I think that's what I'm gonna do next summer. But you know, how do we do this? How do we think about it? Most economic development runs on the model of let's make them like us. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. Okay. We have an obligation to proselytize and convert, right? We want to spread the good news. We don't want to spread the good news by saying, you're going to be Christian or I'm going to kill you. The good news has been spread that way.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
We need to think in whatever way and in whatever situations that we're engaged in, and how the world around us works. And to know that requires us not to say there's a Christian response to this problem. There are good things to do that Christians should think about and talk about, but that we don't necessarily know that there's a good place to stand. Okay? There are places that are better, and Christ tells us help the poor, help the oppressed, visit the prisons, feed them. The Jewish law says take care of the sojourner, the widow, and the orphan. Those are good places to start, but we gotta think about what we're doing. I didn't let you guys talk today.
Okay. Yeah. Could you speak about the economic explosion in China vis-a-vis the idea of freedom to associate?
Yeah, they don't. They're getting there. They're doing much better. China's growing really well, partly because, as Kit told us on Monday, they were so screwed up. They were the Great Leap Forward, the Cultural Revolution. The Chinese just really tore their society apart. So part of a bunch of the economic growth they're experiencing now is just not being screwed up. Okay, look, a place like Rwanda, or Chad, you know, when 900,000 people are dying, and it's people killing each other, what happens to the economic productivity? Okay, there's absolutely no doubt about that. So what China has done is to allow more sophisticated organizations to exist within the framework of the state. You know, they let people have their own plots of land, so you got household production, which solved their agricultural problem, and they have what they're called township and village enterprises, where they allowed provincial and municipal governments to actually begin to start factories and that sort of thing. They really want in places now to let private enterprise come in. The problem is most of the private enterprises also compete with state enterprises, and they're having trouble actually treating people impersonally. So they're growing, but they're headed for some really big decisions. Is China richer than us?
No.
No. Is China richer than Mexico?
No.
No. They're growing faster. That's what they're doing, is they're growing faster. Right? And that's good. That's an unprecedented growth. Right? No, I mean, they have been growing really rapidly for the last 30 years. And if they continue to do that, they will become developed. But they're going to face these problems of access, which they haven't really solved yet. And they know it. They're looking at it. But intentions are not enough here. And lots of people want to be good. Lots of people want to be fair. Lots of people want to be just. You got to figure out how to do it in a way that is self-reinforcing, and particularly with respect to violence.
Unlike Luther, I really like James. Faith without works is dead.
Okay.
I'm here for the first time this week, and surprisingly, I've never heard the word stewardship in my whole week here. Stewardship for me is our use of God's gift and our care for God's gift. I thank you for your sharing your gift of thinking with us and stimulating us to look at our use of that special gift of thinking, which is ours.
Yeah.
And through that thinking, we can provide works.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm not saying no works.
Oh, of course, you're talking about works.
Yeah. I'm saying we got to think about what we're
doing. It's just been interesting for me that we've not used that churchy term, but we're all about that.
Right.
But we're all about that.
I really appreciate you listening and your comments and your discussion all week long. Thanks a lot.